All right, we're going to finish up the unit. Actually, first I should say that up to a couple hours ago at least, only a quarter of you have submitted the field trip thing online, which is a problem because I gave you all week to do it and I gave you a deadline of right now. So most of you are in non-compliance. It's also a problem because if you don't have any idea what I'm talking about, that means you're also not fulfilling your duty to look at the announcements every day or at least sign up for automated announcements. You need to keep an eye on that stuff. So those of you who have not done the field trip thing, you need to do that tonight. Yeah.
Every time I tried to log in, it said that I was invalid. And so then when I tried to remake it, it said you already have an account.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't let me get my username or password, nor would it let me reset.
That's not really surprising because this is entirely new. You guys are the first to ever do it. I don't even have access to it. Only one instructor does that is compiling them from all sections. And I don't know how it's going to work, actually. But you did get through eventually?
No, I didn't.
You didn't? Okay. Okay. Well, try from a desktop, first of all, and try from Firefox or Chrome specifically. Those are going to give you the least problems. And if it still doesn't work under those conditions, email me. Because I don't even know when my own students are submitting them successfully. I just have to rely on the other instructor saying, these are the ones who haven't. Okay, anyway, you should already know this, but there is no laboratory exercise today. It means I have to do all the work, all the hard work. There's no lab because there's two chapters of lecture. So double dose of listening to me, but then we're done for the day. I should also mention that test days are no exceptions to the punctual attendance points. So some people are not in the right mind on test days, so just don't forget to sign in then too. And I mean, that's one reason you should definitely be on time, is to get those points. But also don't be late on any test day simply because you run the risk of me refusing to let you start if it's late. I don't remember whether we talked about this on the first day. On test days, that's not the only thing we do. You don't get this whole five-hour block of time to take a test. And we can't just waste the rest of the time. So on test days, there's also a lecture. It's another reason you have to be here on time, because we have to be over with it by an hour roughly and then start the rest of the night stuff. But anyway, the two lectures we need to get through tonight are going to finish up this evolution unit. And the first of these, which we're looking at right now, is a chapter called Origin of Species, which could be said in just one word as speciation. Speciation is the process of a species being created. And if you think of a phylogenetic tree, which we've looked at already, what is represented on a phylogenetic tree, what represents, I should say, speciation on a phylogenetic tree?
A node.
A node, exactly. A branch point. Every time there's a branch point, that means one lineage has split into two lineages, each of which is a new species. And so that's what we concern ourselves with, really, in this chapter. Now, you have I'm sure you have something in mind of what a species is, and we've already talked about species being a taxon, right? In the hierarchy of classification, domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and then species. so you know what it is from that point of view. But there isn't a single definition of species. I mean, it's a taxon, right? So it's a group of individuals, and since it's classification, it means they have things in common, right? But there isn't just one way to define a species. And that's not true only historically. There's been many different ways of grouping things. Even today, though, there are multiple different what are called species concepts, which is really just another way of defining what a species is. And they're all simultaneously being used. It depends on what kind of biologist you're doing, and what you're really doing or working with as to which of these definitions you would use. There's not one universal definition that can apply to all situations. The one that we are... Well, actually, before I get into those, giving you examples of species concepts, let me just say what's happening here in slide one. This shows you two problems with trying to group things into species. One is that there's similarity between different species. And so similarity means they look alike to us. Well, look, how they look to us used to be really the criterion. That's how we group things together, based on how they appear to us, right? There's other ways you can group things together. And some things that are considered separate species look very similar. And so that's a confusing issue. The converse of that, though, is that, using humans as an example, there's quite a bit of diversity within a species. All humans are members of the same species. But at least to us, we look very different to each other. You know, it might be that a bee looks at humans and says they all look alike, like we say all bees look alike. I don't know, but we look different to each other, even though there's really only one species of humans. So that confuses the issue, too, when you're trying to make these, you know, compartmentalize things into taxa, including species. So there are different species concepts, like I said. Let me just give you some major ones. The one that we're actually going to use in here for what most of the chapter is devoted to is what's called the biological species concept. And the biological species concept defines a species as a group of individuals that reproduce with each other, and more than that, the offspring that they produce are capable of reproducing also. So in other words, they produce fertile offspring. Now, that is really the species concept that probably is closest to what you already had in mind as a species. And it's useful for a lot of biology. But there is a glaring, hopefully obvious, shortcoming to that definition. What is it? If you say that a species is a group of individuals more or less living together but reproducing with each other, what is the problem with that definition? Yeah. That's exactly right. Well, not only does every individual reproduce, but what kind of reproduction are we talking about here in this definition? Sexual reproduction. Which we're all used to because we're a species that reproduces sexually. But actually, most organisms on Earth do not reproduce sexually, right? There's asexual reproduction, there's sexual reproduction. And the things that we tend to think about, which are other animals or plants or fungi. Eukaryotes are largely sexual, but prokaryotes are asexual, right? And so are some eukaryotes. So, obviously, the biological species concept cannot be a universal definition, a universal concept. It doesn't work if you're working in this corner of biology that deals only with prokaryotes. Right? It just doesn't even make any sense since they don't undergo sexual reproduction. So that's why there isn't just one catch-all species concept. There have to be ones that include the asexual organisms of the world as well. That's one reason why there are others. I'm just going to give you a couple others and quickly define them, even though what we're really going to focus on is the biological species concept. There's a concept called the morphological species concept. And what is morphology? What does that have to do with? What does morph mean? Shape or form, exactly. The morphological species concept is really more or less what we started with when we originally, millennia ago, started classifying things, because the morphological species concept is based on how they look to us. If they're similar enough, we lump them together as the same species. Whether or not they have a common ancestor does not come into question there. It's just based on how they look, really, how they're formed. On the other hand, if you do pay attention to ancestry, which is phylogeny, right, that we talked about, then you can use the phylogenetic species concept. That's another one. And that's useful because it's inclusive of even asexual reproducing species. But the phylogenetic species concept says that a species is simply a terminal lineage on a phylogenetic tree. Terminal lineage meaning the very end branch, right? One that doesn't split again yet, but it's at the tip of the tree. That's a species. And so it's based on, it's the smallest group that has a common ancestor for everyone in that group. All right, which is another way of saying a terminal lineage. And that's useful for some biologists. And then just one more example would be the ecological species concept. Obviously, it has something to do with ecology. Well, we'll deal with ecology in the final unit, but ecology is all about interactions between organisms and their surroundings, which includes other organisms, but also non-living stuff in their surroundings. Well, the ecological species concept defines a species based on what we call its niche, which is really just the set of conditions under which it lives. All right? So it depends on what kind of biology you're doing, what kind of subjects you're studying as to which biological species concept, or I mean which species concept you use. But we're going to stick to biological species concept because we mostly talk about sexually reproducing organisms in this course. So that can transition then to slide 2, which, compared to the other slides, takes a little bit of time to get through, so they won't all be this slow. But what we see here are barriers of different types. Barriers to that really, things that keep groups from being considered species, the barriers keep them from being the same species according to the biological species concept. It'll make more sense when I give you some examples, but notice that overall, the top bar there, the two bars in brown, there are two major categories of barriers. Things that are violating the definition of species concept, basically, is what these barriers are. But there are pre-zygotic barriers and post-zygotic barriers, as you see. And obviously that means before zygote and after zygote, right? But what is a zygote? What's the definition of a zygote?
Sperm and egg
Yeah, a zygote is the single cell that's produced when two individual unicellular gametes fuse, one from each of two parents. And so what is that event called that creates the zygote? Fertilization, which is the hallmark of sex. That's what really defines sex biologically, is the fertilization event. And that's why it's not a surprise that that's a big deal in the species concept that's defined based on sexual reproduction. All right, so this has to do with that part of the definition that requires the members of the species reproducing with each other. If they can't or don't, then they're different species. That's by definition of the biological species concept. All right, so anything that interferes or prevents the production of a zygote, in other words, prevents successful fertilization, is considered a prezygotic barrier. A postzygotic barrier is getting closer and closer to obeying the definition because a zygote is produced. But remember, I said that not only do they have to be reproducing together, but they have to produce fertile offspring that are themselves able to reproduce. So let's go through these left to right. Habitat isolation is the first one shown. And this is pretty easy to understand. The habitat is where organisms live, right? And the organism lives. So if you have some individuals in one habitat and some individuals in another habitat, it might be that they would reproduce with each other. And I keep saying reproduce with each other rather than mating, because not all sexual species mate, right? We do, animals in general, most animals do. Plants don't, for instance, though, but they're just as sexual as we are, right? So mating is just one way of getting your gametes together. But anyway, habitat isolation simply means the individuals are separated from each other and never really come into contact, nor do their gametes come into contact with each other. So obviously, even though they might choose to, if they met each other, they're not going to reproduce with each other, right? And therefore, by definition, they are not the same species. Now, that's habitat isolation is a spatial isolation, meaning it's isolation or separation in space. But you can also have temporal isolation. And what does temporal mean? Spatial means in space. Temporal means in time. Same root as in temporary, for instance. Temporal isolation exists when organisms are living in the same space, so they encounter each other, or in other words, they have the ability to mate or otherwise reproduce with each other because they occupy the same space. But it's not successful because they have different reproductive seasons. Most organisms can only reproduce a certain time of the year, right? And if those are at different times of the year in two groups, then those groups are not going to be the same species because they're not going to be able to produce zygotes. Next is behavioral isolation. This one uses the blue-footed boobies as an example, but there are many examples of behavioral isolation. This really simply means they could, if they wanted to, they're choosing not to. They live together, they're sexually active at the same times of year, they're just ignoring each other for whatever reason, based on how they behave. So if they do that, they're isolating themselves and therefore preventing mating attempts, and without a mating attempt, you're not going to get fertilization. Okay. Next one, which is still prezygotic, is mechanical isolation. Mechanical has to do with shape as well. Picture F here is the example of these two snails are actually trying to mate. And if you look at them, you would say, well, they definitely look like two individuals of the same species. Once again, that's relying on how they look to us, right? Which is not necessarily anything important. But you would easily say, if you just saw these, since they're almost identical, that they're probably members of the same species. And they might be perfectly compatible in terms of their gametes. And in fact, they're trying to mate, as you see. The problem is, one of these has a clockwise swirl, and the other one has a counterclockwise swirl. So they're like mirror images of each other. And they don't match up. Their genitals don't match up when they try to mate. So even though they go through the motions, it's not going to be successful fertilization. And so they remain as separate species, according to this biological species concept. It's getting closer and closer, though, to a zygote as we move toward the right. And final one that's still prezygotic is gametic isolation. Now, gametic isolation refers to isolation of gametes, right? And what are gametes? What are gametes? Does no one in here know what gametes are, or are you just not being active? So you can't even answer that question, whether you're being active or not? Well, I've used the word gametes multiple times already, and no one said, what does that mean? So if you really don't know what I'm saying, you should stop me and ask what it means. On the other hand, if you do know what it means, you should volunteer the information when I'm asking what it means. So all of you have no idea what gametes are? Is that what you're saying?
I have an idea of what it is, I just can't find it.
What's your idea?
That's what defines the traits that you're going to end up getting.
Well, molecularly that's true, because gametes carry DNA. Gametes are cells. What kind of cells? Sex cells. Gametes is just the unisex term. Sperm are gametes, they're male gametes. Eggs are gametes as well. They are female gametes. And by the way, it's not always called sperm or egg. Some species use different words for them, but that's what gametes are. Gametes are the things that fuse in fertilization. That's what defines fertilization. Fusion of gametes from two parents into one cell that we call the zygote. All right? Now, gametic isolation's example here is sea urchins, which are animals that live on the seafloor. They have these spines. I'm sure you've seen them, or you likely have seen them. Anyway, unlike most animals, sea urchins don't mate. The male will ejaculate those gametes that are in the ejaculate, just are broadcast into the water that the sea urchins live in, and those sperm will land wherever. The vast majority of them will be unsuccessful, just like in a human, right? Almost all of the sperm go wasted, but there's a hell of a lot of them that are released. So some of them get lucky enough to land on a female sea urchin. And that's how fertilization takes place. Right? So if there is... Well, not only do they have to get lucky enough to land on the right place. Go ahead.
Sorry, I have a question.
That's all right.
When you're saying, so it's gametic, so that means the cells, they're not...
Well, I haven't actually gotten to why this is an example yet. I'm just explaining sea urchin lifestyle. But not only do they, to the successful ones, have to land on a sea urchin, it has to be the right kind of sea urchin. the right species, in other words. And this brings up the definition. In other words, some of their gametes are going to land on sea urchins, but if they try to fuse with the eggs of those sea urchins, their gametes will not be chemically compatible. Just like if human sperm are put onto sea urchins' eggs, you're not going to get successful fertilization. The cells chemically reject each other, the gametes. And so that's gametic isolation. All right, even if they go through all the motions otherwise. So any of those that we've just... Does that explain it, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay. Any of those that we've gone through so far, those all prevent, one way or another, successful fertilization. A zygote, and therefore, is not produced. And that's why those are all prezygotic barriers. And therefore, the groups involved would be separate species according to the biological species concept. You can go farther than that, though, and have postzygotic barriers. The first of which is reduced hybrid viability. Well, first of all, a hybrid is an offspring of two different species. Two species can sometimes produce zygotes, even though they're separate species by the biological species concept. Well, sometimes, very seldom, this goes okay, but usually there's some problem. Reduced hybrid viability is a problem. Viability refers to ability to survive. And so, reduced hybrid viability means, yes, hybrids are produced. These two different species can mate, for instance, or somehow get their gametes together, and offspring are produced, but there's chemical reasons that it just does not work well, and so they rarely get past, maybe they might get past the zygote stage, but not the embryo stage. Or they might even get past those early developmental stages, but just not be able to survive long enough to ever reproduce on their own. Most of them die early. So that's reduced hybrid viability. On the other hand, getting even closer to success, you have reduced hybrid fertility, which mules are a good example of. You know, you don't get mules by breeding mules. Mules are sterile. You can only get a mule by breeding a horse and a donkey. And every time you need a mule, you have to get a new horse and donkey to do it again. Right? You can't breed mules out of other mules. And that's despite the fact that a mule, once it's created, is a strong, healthy animal that can live a natural lifetime. They're just sterile, so they can't mate with other mules. And so even though their viability is not reduced, they're healthy, they have reduced fertility if they're sterile. And even though they might have a normal lifetime in terms of an organism individual, it still violates the biological species concept because of that part of the definition that says that the offspring have to themselves be fertile and be able to reproduce with each other. All right? Well, even closer than that, and the last one on the postzygotic barriers is hybrid breakdown. And there's a good reason that a plant is shown here for an example, because plants not only hybridize a lot more easily than animals, it's a lot. You have a lot more chance of successfully crossing two species of plants and getting something that lives than you are with crossing two animals, for instance. But not only that, hybrid plants that do live, actually some of them do very well, not only in surviving, but can even reproduce on their own. Some of those that can reproduce, though, they can only do this for a couple generations, and then something breaks down. So they get closest to fulfilling the entire definition of biological species, but unless it's an indefinite number of generations that can continue undergoing sexual reproduction, then it doesn't fulfill the definition. So those would still be considered separate species. On the other hand, you do have some hybrids that are now new species, because they can then just reproduce with each other indefinitely and they become a new species. All right, let's go to three. We can speed things up a little now. Well, speaking of hybrids, this is just giving you an example of an animal hybrid, a so-called growler bear, which is obviously a combination of the names polar and grizzly. These are two separate species according to the biological species concept. And they occupy different ranges, but they do occasionally come into contact with each other. And they can choose to mate, and sometimes they do. And if that mating attempt is successful, sometimes you have growler bears being produced. So this is not just an example of a hybrid, just to show you one, but it just shows you another shortcoming of this biological species concept, because the growler bear is not considered a species, but it obviously is not a grizzly, and it's obviously not a polar, and it obviously exists, so you have to deal with it somehow, but you don't deal with it in this limited species concept. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, let's look at four and start examining how speciation can happen in nature. Speciation, remember, is creation of a new species, or separation of a lineage into two separate lineages, as we've said. Well, this can happen in two major ways, either of two major ways, which you can see listed on the bottom of the slide. Allopatric speciation, sympatric speciation are the two ways. And notice what the word share, patric, like in patriot, a word that comes from fatherland is really what it literally means. But it refers to location. And allo means different, whereas sim means same. So allopatric speciation is named for the fact that it is speciation that occurs when there is spatial isolation of two groups. They're geographically separated. Yeah. Yes, allo means different. And that's what allopatric speciation is. Speciation that occurs because two groups that used to be two subgroups of the same species have been separated somehow from each other. Sympatric, on the other hand, means speciation that occurs even though the two new species that used to be one species are still living together. All right? They're still in contact with each other. And just to give you a cartoon example of how this can happen, you have an original single population on the top. It's the fish that we care about, not the plants that are just drawn for aesthetic purposes. And you can see the water level, right? They're all one's population living in the same volume of water, right? They can get past that hump because there's water above it. So it's all one space. Well, if something happens and the water level drops and you have this hill here in the middle, now all of a sudden where you had one volume of water, you have two. And so that separates that original population into two groups that can't intermix anymore. Right? You're stuck in whatever side you get stuck in originally. And so that's the easier to understand way to have speciation. They're not immediately new species, by the way. It's just easy to understand that separation can lead to speciation because when that separation occurs, each subgroup is now going to evolve differently because they have non-identical conditions that they're living in, right? And so natural selection is going to work at least a little bit differently in each of these two subpopulations and continue to cause differences between the two subpopulations as each generation evolution occurs until eventually they're considered separate species. That's allopatric speciation. And not only is it easier to understand than sympatric, but it also is much more common. This is the easier way for speciation to occur in reality, in nature. But look at the cartoon for St. Patrick's speciation. The water level has not dropped. And so they are still living together, which is what makes it St. Patrick. But they still have speciated. Notice now you have a blue species in addition to the original gold species. So something has caused them to no longer reproduce with each other, which is what makes them, by definition of the biological species concept, separate species. And we'll talk about some ways that that can happen, but these are the two general categories. Let's first take a look at some examples of allopatric speciation, the more common way. This is slide 5. Well, this is actually a case of exactly what A was showing you in the previous slide. These fish are separate species, but they live in pools that are separated from each other because of drop in water level. It used to be just like the cartoon, you know, there used to be a bigger pool that all the subpools lived together, and then the water level dropped, and now there are several different subpools that cause speciation. This is just a couple of them. And obviously they look different now. You can tell that natural selection is operating differently in the two groups. But look at the body forms and these kind of graphs in blue above them that show how streamlined they are. Well, the one on the left, this is how the members of this species look nowadays. Because they happen to, you know, originally when they were all together and the water level dropped, it's random as to where you land, right? As to which pool you land in. Well, the ones that became this, that led to offspring that looked like the one on A, happened to land in a pool that has a lot of things that are predators to them, that could eat them. So there is a high predation rate. It's a dangerous place to live, in other words, to survive. And therefore, natural selection is going to strongly favor individuals that happen to be able to elude the predators, which in this case can be done by darting away very quickly. If they can sprint, the swimming equivalent of sprinting, then they can stay alive longer and therefore have a better chance of passing on their sprinter genes to the next generation, right? So each generation, they become, on average, more and more like these sprinters. You can only do that for short bursts, and it takes a lot of energy to do that. But if it saves your life, it's definitely better than being eaten, because those eaten fish are not going to pass anything on, right? Well, in the other pool, they happen to land in a pool that doesn't have very many predators. So for them, it would be a waste of energy to go sprinting all the time. It would be much better if they were just streamlined in a way that they could use minimal muscle energy to just be marathoners, really, more than sprinters. And therefore, they wouldn't have to find as much food to fuel their swimming. And so that's what got favored by natural selection in that pool. And after enough generations, they became different enough that even if you were to put them back together, they would probably no longer reproduce with each other. They're separate species at that point. So that's allopatric because of separation. Another example of allopatric speciation in 6. Here you see only 2 pairs of species, 4 species overall, of snapping shrimp. This is at the Isthmus of Panama. An isthmus is a narrow land with water on either side. There's actually 30 overall species, 15 pairs of species. And I say 15 pairs because remember we talked about sister taxa when we looked at trees? What are sister taxa? How do you know things are sister taxa? Or one taxon is a sister taxon to another one. How would you know that?
Sister taxa is the species that they're
That's right. On a tree, those are the two lineages that one node turns into. And they're more like each other than either one is like anything else on the tree, right? They are the most closely related. So, if you look at these 30, and you only see four here, but if you look at all 30, there's 15 pairs of sister species. And in all 15 of those cases, one species is in the Pacific Ocean and its sister species is in the Atlantic Ocean. And so that strongly suggests that how they became separate species to begin with is isolation, which is explainable because the Isthmus of Panama has not always been there. This used to be one body of water. And when the Isthmus grew from below sea level and became an isthmus, it then separated all of these, what were 15 species, right, living together. It separated them into halves for each of those 15. And those halves then became separate species, which are more related to each other than they are to anything else because they came from the same species. You see what I'm saying there? So it split it into an Atlantic version and a Pacific version for each of 15 different species, and so now there are 30 species. So that's pretty definite that there was allopatric speciation that was occurring there. And here's just one more example for allopatric speciation, slide 7. But this is an experimental one rather than just a natural observation. Here the scientists were working with Drosophila, which is a genus of fruit flies that are often used for genetic experiments. They're used because they're fairly easy to take care of. They survive well in the lab. But importantly, they also don't take very long for a generation. Just a week and a half is a generation for them. So if you want to study evolution over many generations, you want to use an organism that you can get a lot of generations in not very much human time. So anyway, that's what we're using here. And there's an initial population, all the same species, living together in these laboratory bottles on what we call medium. The medium is simply the stuff that they live on and use as food. Okay? So then, after they're living together for so many generations, they separate that initial population into two separated populations that have different media. Okay, so they separate it into one that has starch in it, and another group gets now a medium that has maltose in it. Either one of them is fine to keep them alive, but they're different sets of conditions now that they've given them, right? In other words, they've created not only separation, but they've given different sets of living conditions, and therefore natural selection should operate differently in the two. Does that make sense? If you made them identical, natural selection, you'd expect to operate the same way in both of them. So they just left them alone and let them go through 40 generations, I think it was. Yeah, 40 generations, that's not even a year to us. But 40 generations is a lot of evolution time, basically. So then I don't want to say they reintroduced them because it wasn't the original flies anymore. It was the great, 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 whatever, however many times, grandchildren of them. They put them together then into one jar, and therefore they were allowed to mate if they wanted to. And they just, I didn't mention it, but they marked them somehow so they could tell which was which. And then they just observed them once they were introduced with each other. And it's not perfect avoidance of each other yet after 40 generations, but notice that there is a strong dependence. What this data show you, in case it's not obvious from the tables, is that when they introduced them together, the starch bred ones preferred to mate with other starch bred ones, even though they had free access to the maltose ones as well. And similarly, the maltose ones only wanted to mate with other maltose ones. So, since it's not complete isolation, these probably would eventually get back into one species. But if you'd let this go for several more generations, there might have been complete avoidance of the other type, in which case it would be allopatric speciation, and you have separate species. Oh, by the way, the second one, the reason that they have two bottles of starch and two bottles of maltose, really more than two, but more than one is the important point here, is to test for whether it's just something about the jar that is causing this. And it's not, because when they tested for that, they didn't care. It didn't make any difference. That's why all these numbers are the same. So it's really to the flies that matter, not the kind of bottle. Okay, well, that's enough examples of allopatric speciation. Now I should say, starting with 8, that we can talk about three major ways in which sympatric speciation can occur. Remember, any sympatric speciation means the two species that get created from the one are living together. That's what defines it as sympatric. And that's rarer, as you would expect, because if they are living together, you'd expect them to continue to reproduce with each other. Well, one of these ways, one mechanism for sympatric speciation is called polyploidy. And this happens much more easily in plants than in animals or other groups. It's not impossible in the other groups, but it's more frequently observed in plants. Polyploidy, you can't understand that word unless you can tell me what ploidy is, and we certainly have covered that in this course. So what is ploidy? Let me rephrase it to it's how many of each kind of chromosome a cell has. You number chromosomes 1 through whatever. Like for humans, it's 1 through 23, right? The ploidy is how many number 1s and how many number 2s you have. So that, well, we've been talking about haploid and diploid. Well, those aren't the only two possibilities. Haploid means there's only one of each kind of chromosome. Diploid means there's two of each kind of chromosome. But there can be triploid, tetraploid, and so on. But anyway, that's what ploidy is. How many of each kind of chromosome there are. Well, when we talk about sexual reproduction, what I said earlier is that it's the defining process, the thing that actually makes it sex, is fertilization, right? And that doubles the ploidy, because you have two gametes combining their chromosomes into one cell, right? So two haploid gametes produce a diploid zygote. That has twice the ploidy than compared to the gametes. And therefore, fertilization doubles the ploidy. That's why you couldn't possibly, in a life cycle, an ongoing life cycle, have nothing but fertilization. Because you can't continue to double the ploidy every generation, right? You would quickly run out of room in the cell. It wouldn't possibly be able to hold a continuously doubling amount of DNA. It's amazing that it holds what it does already. So there is, in any sexual species, there's a counteracting mechanism that undoes the doubling of ploidy that fertilization accomplishes. Do you know what I'm talking about? What is it that undoes that doubling? It halves the ploidy instead of doubles it. What is that process called? It occurs in all sexual species as well.
Meiosis,
exactly. That's why meiosis evolved. You have to have something that will cut the ploidy in half if you're going to double it every generation. That way, it just goes back and forth between double, single, double, single, without actually building up every generation. Okay? But anyway, that meiosis produces the cells that can act as gametes. And meiosis involves disjunction. What is called disjunction, which is just a word, it's the noun form of disjoin, which means to split apart, right? In meiosis, what splits apart are pairs of homologous chromosomes. So each cell gets one set and the other cell gets the other set. All right? Disjunction is what's supposed to happen and what happens almost always. That's the normal. Sometimes an accident happens, though, and you have what's called non-disjunction. Failure to properly disjoin, in other words. And so you can have one cell that gets both chromosomes in that of that type, and the other cell doesn't get anything. All right? So usually that's not survivable. The cells will just die. They won't be useful as gametes. But every once in a while, and especially in plants, if this accident occurs, and if it happens multiple times in the same plant parent, then those two gametes can be compatible with each other because plants are able to fertilize themselves, some plants, right? So if this accident happens in such a way that you have two gametes with the wrong number of chromosomes, but they're wrong in the same way as each other, they can then be compatible with each other and create, just immediately in one generation, a new species. Because that offspring is going to have a different number of chromosomes compared to the parent, right? And they'll be only compatible with others of its own type, which they can produce now that they exist as an organism. And that's what's really not so well described in this cartoon, but that's what's being portrayed here. So it's just a single parent through accidental meiotic non-disjunction giving rise to abnormal gametes that are compatible with each other, creating a brand new species immediately. So this is very fast speciation. And since it evolved, it's called polyploidy because you have multiple sets of chromosomes. But since this example involved only one original parent, it's called autopolyploidy. Auto meaning self. Now the same, largely the same thing can happen as in slide 9, involving two different parents. Still, you have to have non-disjunction occurring. There has to be accidents forming these abnormal gametes, but if they happen to be compatible with each other from the different parents, then you're still going to have a brand new species. Since this involved accidents happening in two different parents, though, instead of autopolyploidy, it's called allopolyploidy. Allo, again, means different, just like in allopatric. Don't be confused by the word allopolyploidy, though, because it is not allopatric speciation. Allopolyploidy is still polyploidy, which is sympatric speciation. Okay? Because there's still, it's no separation of groups occurring here. So that happens much more easily in plants because for whatever reasons they just tolerate abnormal numbers of chromosomes, whereas in most animals that just has drastic consequences and they don't survive. Well, that's one of, I said I was going to give you three ways in which sympatric speciation can occur. The second one, though, I don't have a picture for, though, so we're not really to 10 yet. The second mechanism of sympatric speciation is called habitat differentiation. Now, the habitat, like we've said, is where the organisms live, set of conditions that they live in. And so habitat differentiation means different parts of that habitat are going to be specialized on by different subsets of the original group. Probably make a lot more sense if I just give you the example that this book gives, which is for a type of insect called apple maggot flies, so named because the the maggots, the larval stage, grow up in apples. They lay eggs in apples and they eat the apples as they develop. The maggots do. Well, originally, and this is somewhere in the Americas, Midwest or something, I forget specifically where, it doesn't really matter. For most of the of their history, though, their main source of food, which is also where they lay their eggs, their reproduction grounds, was the hawthorn tree producing hawthorn fruit. But then, a couple hundred years ago, apples were introduced to the region. And they are also good for laying eggs in and having maggots develop in. So some did. The thing about this is, though, that the apples mature as fruit earlier in the year than hawthorn fruit do. And so this the apple, that set of conditions of living on the apple favored individuals of this insect that just happened by random variation to come to reproductive maturity earlier, because they would be better matched time-wise to the development of the apples. Whereas the ones that were using hawthorn, that favored by natural selection ones that developed slower. You see what I'm saying? To match it up time-wise. And so this, over generations, led to more and more temporal isolation. They were in the same place because the two trees grew together, but they became temporarily isolated because some of them were reproducing earlier in the year and the others were producing later in the year. And eventually they became two separate species. But it's called, that's first of all, it's sympatric because they're still together more or less. But it's called habitat differentiation because what they ended up doing was specializing in different parts of the same habitat. Right? Okay. Now we can get to 10, which is the third type of sympatric speciation, and that's called sexual selection. Using fish, as you see here, that are from Lake Victoria, and there's two different species seen here. Notice that they're in the same genus, which is what the P stands for. So they're related to each other. Obviously, they're pretty similar in appearance, but they're in the same genus. They are just different species. This is the species name. Well, if you take these out of their natural habitat, Lake Victoria, and you put them in a laboratory and shine on them just monochromatic orange light, monochromatic simply means one color. When you shine orange light on them, they not only look much more similar to each other to us, they also look very similar to each other, to each other. And they therefore start thinking the other is one of them and choose to mate with them. So in their natural light, they can tell they're different. And even though they have compatible gametes, they're just behaviorally choosing not to mate with each other, which is what keeping them separate species. If you give them this artificial light, though, so they can't tell themselves apart, then they're going to become a species again because they're going to start reproducing with each other. That's what's happening there. Well, that's an artificial situation, but it still demonstrates the definition of biological species concept. In 11, we're looking at the idea of a hybrid zone, shown here in red. Now, not all hybrid zones are narrow and long like this one on this map. They don't have to be a line like that, but that's a pretty clearly defined one. Any hybrid zone, though, is simply where you are likely to find hybrids of two species. And so it makes sense that a hybrid zone geographically is simply where two species that occupy different ranges that overlap, and therefore the members of those two species sometimes come into contact within that hybrid zone, choose to mate or otherwise reproduce with each other, and therefore produce hybrids. The graph doesn't really show anything surprising. Here you have a yellow-bellied toad with its own range, fire-bellied toad with its own range, but the two do overlap at the hybrid zone. And when the hybrids are produced, well, the not surprising thing is that if you look at just the non-overlapping part of the yellow-bellied toad range, they have certain alleles that define that population. The other alleles of that same gene are found in the other range much more often than this allele. That's why these two parts are different. And then, not surprisingly, in the hybrid zone, you have both alleles appearing because they're combining their allele pools there. But hybrid zones are interesting not only ecologically, but also as far as defining species are concerned. Well, if you have a hybrid zone, what are the possible outcomes? Slide 12 gives you the three possibilities. So this big arrow on the left that's splitting into two represents some event, some separation, right? These three blobs, those are populations of the same species. Now they're separated from each other, which is why they're separate populations. But why are they still considered the same species? Because they're not completely separated. The little black arrows going between the blue blobs, that represents gene flow between the populations, right? They're migrating, for instance. And therefore, even though we define them as separate populations, they're still really interbreeding and keeping it all as one species. Well, then something happens, and it doesn't matter what it is, earthquake or whatever, something happens to separate one of these populations from the other two. And naturally enough, they go down different evolutionary trajectories because natural selection works at least slightly differently in their different conditions. And so the divergence of the two arrows represents them getting farther and farther apart, not in space, farther and farther apart in differences between their traits, right? They're getting more and more separate as species. Okay, then we have something that introduces a hybrid zone. And once again, it doesn't matter how that happens, but now all of a sudden, sometime after their original separation, they're able to encounter each other again. And they're able to undergo mating attempts or try to reproduce. So the question is, like I said originally, what happens? There's three possible outcomes. First is reinforcement. What's being reinforced here is the notion of them being separate species. So notice that in reinforcement, the hybrid zone gets diminished because fewer and fewer hybrids are being made, even if they come into contact. Even if the two species come into contact, they're for one reason or another, becoming more and more incompatible sexually. So that's what's being reinforced, the fact that they're separate species, and they'll continue to diverge, get more and more different from each other. Next possibility is fusion, which is kind of the opposite of reinforcement. And this is exactly what I said would happen for the orange light, right? Because they would now think they're the same species and start mating with each other, and by definition that means you're all one species again. So fusion means what were two species or were becoming two species fuse back into one. Well, the only other mathematical possibility is stability, which is kind of the middle ground between these other two extremes. Notice the hybrid zone is stable. There's always going to be a hybrid zone. There's always going to be some hybrids made, but we still consider them to be two separate species, and they're not diverging from each other. They're staying their differences are continuous or static. All right. 13. These look like the same fish for a good reason. These are photographs. The other ones were cartoons, but these are the same fish. And I gave you an experimental scenario with the orange light. But what we're looking at here is that same thing actually happening in nature. For the unfortunate reason that human activity has caused the water to become so polluted that they can't tell each other apart anymore. And so sexual selection isn't working as strongly as it was in clear water because they're unable to tell each other apart. And so what were considered separate species are now fusing into a single species again. It's an example of fusion that I just showed you in the last slide. This slide is all about the tempo of speciation, the timing of how quickly it happens. And as you can see here, there are two models, the punctuated model, the gradual model. Look at the difference in the trees. They both involve a divergence, of course, because the speciation involves a divergence on a tree, right? A node splitting. But look at the punctuated model. That split happens and the divergence is rapid. They get quickly because the horizontal really represents time, right? So they split apart quickly and become very different in a short amount of time in the punctuated model. And then they don't continue getting so different after that. They become kind of parallel in their representation by the tree. On the gradual model, on the other hand, separation occurs, but it's very gradually that the two lineages become different from each other evolutionarily, or in terms of fitness. So it's easy to think that either one of these could work, right? So it's not that there's a right one and a wrong one. You determine which ones it is. Both of them can happen in nature for different reasons. But that's the names of those models. I think this might be the last slide of this one. Here we have some flowering plants. It's two different species of the same genus. Lewisii is one species, Cardinalis is the other species. And on the left column, these are how they looked before experimental manipulation. So the Lewisii had the pink flower, Cardinalis had the orange flower. These are insect-pollinated flowers. You know, plants do not mate, right? They're planted in place, so they don't encounter the other parent, but their gametes have to get together by definition of fertilization, and so the pollen has to reach the other plant. That can happen randomly by the wind, but it's much more efficient if it's delivered by an animal like an insect. So insects, you know, that's the whole idea of flowers. They're attractive to insects. They don't do the plant any good otherwise. It's just something they build to attract pollinators to them. And shape is important, color is important, scent is important, and so on. But the point here is that how the plant evolves, which is one species, obviously has to do with its own genes, but it also is largely affected by what other species are doing around it, because it involves interaction with animals, the pollinators. And to demonstrate that what they did here was a little bit of genetic manipulation. They took genes out of each plant and inserted them into the other plant species. And that's what gave you the ones on the right. So now you have a flower on the upper right that is a Lewisii. It has the shape of a natural Lewisii, but it has the color more of the Cardinalis. They transplanted the color genes. And so in the bottom right one, you have a correctly shaped cardinalis flower, but with the color of a Lewisii. And then after they created these, they just sat back and looked at what happened. And what happened is that the pollinators that preferred one or the other switched to the other style because they were mostly color attracted. And when that happens, obviously that's going to change how these things evolve in time, right? Because those pollinators are carrying their alleles. They're carrying their gametes. And so it's not just for plants. That's true for all species. Nothing evolves in isolation. Evolution, and therefore speciation, is affected by the evolution of all the other species that are around it. All right, that's one.